President Donald Trump has directed the Department of Defense and the Pentagon to start the process of establishing a space force. Trump says the sixth branch of the military would be, quote, separate but equal. So what would a space force look like and what would it do? Are there echoes of Star Wars, the strategic defense initiative proposed by President Reagan in 1983? And if the US doesn't establish a space force, will other countries go ahead and do it first? What's at stake and what does it mean for Florida's space industry? We're taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252, and we're over on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining me in the studio, 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, welcome to Intersection.
Happy to be here.
And we're also joined by Roger Handberg. He's a political scientist at the University of Central Florida. He focuses on space and military policy. Roger, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
And we're joined too by Laura Forsick. She's founder of Astrolytical. It's a space analysis and consulting firm. Laura, very happy to have you as well on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Brendan, let's start with you. When and how did President Donald Trump make the ask for a space force?
So there was a meeting of the National Space Council earlier this week, and the National Space Council kind of streamlines both public and private space ventures. And it was kind of an unexpected announcement here. The Space Council was meeting to talk about mitigating space debris and space junk. And during opening arguments, he made the ask for a space force, saying that we need to be dominant in space, and asked his joint chiefs and his DOD representatives at this meeting to say, hey, I want a space force.
So it was a bit of a surprise.
It wasn't a surprise to people who have been following this. He's made the ask before at campaign-style rallies earlier this year. There was an effort to do this last year. But it was a surprise to the Pentagon and the Air Force the day of. When reporters were calling for comment, they seemed to have no idea that this was happening and were struggling to get a message out there. So it took some time. So it seemed to be that all the people that needed to know about this did not know about it.
So what was the rationale for it then? What did the president say about why we need this new branch of the military?
Yeah, so during the initial remarks at the National Space Council meeting earlier this week, he said the U.S. needed to dominate space, and he reiterated that at a campaign stop on Wednesday. It brought a little bit of sound for you to play. Here he is earlier this week talking about the Space Force.
We're going to be going to space. Space Force. Space Force. So we have the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Coast Guard. But we have the Air Force. Now we're going to have the Space Force because it's a whole... We need it.
All right, so we need a Space Force. Not a lot of specifics in there, Brendan, though. What's been the initial response to the president's request?
The response has been a little bit lackluster. Some lawmakers have been coming out, because I think it's important to note that the president can't create another branch of the military. And Professor Handberg can talk a little bit more about that. But he would need the help of Congress to get this through. And some folks have already come out saying they don't know if there's a need for it, if there's the money for it. Florida's Senator Bill Nelson, he sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's been a little hesitant to embrace a space force, and so have some other lawmakers out there as well.
Well, turning to you, Roger Handberg, is there a need for a space force?
No, not in the short term. I mean, the question is, what do they do? Right now, we still have... A space force that's robotic, you could do something like that. But the implication is that this would be a space force which is going to send people out a la Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we have enough trouble getting people to orbit anyway. The United States can't get anyone there, and we're hoping to do it by end of 2019, somewhere in there before we'll be able to get them back to the space station, which is critical. The president's inaccurate. There's another military service that may feel very neglected, the Marine Corps.
Right.
So, you know, if you start proliferating these branches, that's going to hit your budget.
Mm-hmm.
Your budget's going to explode. This is why, back in the 50s, President Eisenhower took the military out of human spaceflight and created NASA with Congress's consent. The reason was he did not want a space race among the military services and creating budget debacle.
Mm-hmm.
This would be, where do you get the money? Some money could be taken out of the Air Force if you transfer the U.S. Air Force Space Command. But the rest of the money is going to have to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And in the context of what the military is trying to do, with a, you know, we don't have the global war on terror, but we effectively do because we got people in 70 countries. There's a resource problem. And that means that there's going to be a lot of pushing and shoving. Among the argument in the services was before, because the president had said this, and this, anytime a president says something, even in passing, people pay attention to it.
Sure.
But what they were talking about, let's start a space combat command, combatant command.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we had back in up till 2002. We abolished the U.S. Space Command, which drew elements from the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army. We abolished it because we at that time had the theory that there could only be a certain number of combatant commands.
Mm-hmm.
So when we stood up the Northern Command to defend the United States, the Space Command got basically waxed.
Mm-hmm.
The creation of the Cyber Combatant Command seems to have eliminated that part of the restriction. But a Space Combatant Command, which is within the services still, is probably a more realistic proposition mm-hmm. than an independent Space Force.
We're talking to Roger Hanberg about the potential for a Space Force. Want to hear your thoughts as well. We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can send in your comments and questions on Twitter as well over at WMFE Orlando. What are your thoughts on the Space Force? Are you worried about the money aspect of it? Do you think it's a good thing? Is it going to help enhance the security, the dominance of space for the United States? Could other countries do it first? 1-866-338-5252. Or could you think of a better use for the kind of money that would be needed to put a Space Force into effect? Got a call coming in here. We've got Adele, I believe, calling in. What are your thoughts about this idea, Adele?
Good morning. My thoughts are that this is a really old-fashioned idea of dominance and dominating space. And we're a wealthy nation that could use its resources in a better aspect. We have American citizens. In Puerto Rico, don't even have a light bulb,
mm-hmm.
don't even have light. And some of them don't have food, and they have to wait in line for gas. And we want to dominate space. We have people here who live in, you know, on a government assistance that we can create jobs for them with that money. I mean, this is a Cold War type of propaganda that we want to dominate space and send space troopers to different planets. We got to be realistic with our money and use it where we should,
mm-hmm.
where it's going to help people.
So you're saying focus on things, issues we have to solve here on Earth before thinking about more stuff in space. Well, I appreciate your call. Thanks for weighing in there. Let me throw that to you. I mean, the notion of kind of drawing resources into that, where there are still kind of issues to think about here on Earth, Roger Hanberg, even some of the other stuff that we still need to think about in space that has to be taken care of, like space junk, for example. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that his statements are pretty realistic in terms of how many Americans see space. They're in favor of it. But you got to go back to when we launched the first the Apollo 11
mm-hmm.
launch. There was a demonstration outside the gates of the Kennedy Space Center opposed to the launch, opposed to the Apollo program, because we had people in poverty, et cetera. So this is a recurring theme. Why do you need the money? And that's, in this context, it's probably a more realistic question because it's not really clear. The counterargument to the Space Force, which is really not a counterargument but a variation on it, is what we need is the equivalent of a Coast Guard, a Space Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we get a lot of people in orbit, tourists and other things, there are going to be situations arise where we're going to have to maybe go and get them.
Right.
Now, that sounds foolish, but that was one of the problems with the Columbia disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we had known about the damage to the wing that destroyed the Columbia on reentry, we literally had no way to get there. They couldn't get to the International Space Station because they were too far away, and they didn't have the fuel power to get there. We didn't have the ability to mount some kind of operation to get the crew off before the vehicle returned to Earth.
So you're saying a Space Guard, like a Coast Guard, might be a better sort of step before
at least
a Space
in the
Force.
Short term, mm-hmm. because of that kind of organization will have a purpose. You don't need it immediately. because right now there's not that much they can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have the vehicles. You know, what it was, you'd have to have vehicles that would be in space their entire career. They would never return to Earth.
Mm.
That's where, you, for example, you would get them. You may fly people you rescue, quote unquote, to an international space station or the equivalent. Might be the Chinese space station.
Right.
You know, by the time this would be a feasible kind of operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about some of the other countries that are sort of eyeing space, putting more resources into it, whether it's exploration or whether it might be for military purposes or others, I want to bring Laura Forsick into the conversation, founder of Astrolytical. She's involved in space analysis and consulting. Laura, the U.S. is a signatory to the Outer Space Treaty. What kind of guidelines does that treaty bring to this discussion, and how does a Space Force, or how would a Space Force fit into that policy?
Yeah, so the Outer Space Treaty was signed back in 1967 by over 100 countries, the United States being one of them, and it specifically outlines how we should conduct ourselves in space. And it mentions that space should be for peaceful purposes. Now, it says for celestial bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You can interpret that more broadly and say, you know, low Earth orbit as well as the celestial bodies, or you can be very, very specific. There are different interpretations, as well as it bans weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons mm-hmm. in space. Weapons of mass destruction, of course, is different from conventional weapons, so there is that distinction there that may allow for weaponization of space. You have to remember, back in the 60s, they were already in a space race. They had already militarized space. So this isn't a new concept.
Right.
And this is something that has been debated for decades now.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of impediment would that Outer Space Treaty put into place if you're looking to create a space force which has a sort of more military role or responsibility in space?
Well, as I said, it outlines where you are allowed to interact. Like, for example, you can have conventional weapons, but you cannot have nuclear weapons. You cannot have weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be important to note that, as Professor Hanberg mentioned, we have a space command under the U.S. Air Force. We've had that for 35 years. And so this is not new for us, and it's not new for other countries as well. China established their own quote-unquote space force, a separate military branch, back in 2015. Another country is Russia as well, has also done a lot to militarize space. So in a way, this is an evolution, but it's also something new.
Mm-hmm.
Not so very new, but a little bit.
Right. I want to get to a couple of questions on Twitter. This one from Brian Chapman. He writes, in the past, there were crewed shuttle Department of Defense missions. Will the Space Force also have a crewed program? And if so, what spacecraft will they use? Kind of to your point there, Roger Hanberg. But Brendan, your thoughts on that?
Oh, we don't know. This is a proposal that has just kind of come up with the president saying, I want a Space Force, and the details have been quite slim. The Air Force does have quite a few space missions. The X-37B, our listeners might be familiar with that. That's the uncrewed miniature shuttle-looking thing.
The secret shuttle.
The secret shuttle likes to wake us up with sonic booms whenever it returns here. But really, there is no crewed military vehicle on the drawing board, at least that I know of, and I don't think that there are the details that have been released in this proposal. Even earlier when our caller said, you know, putting troopers on other planets, that's more detail than the president gave
right.
to what he wants in the Space Force as well. So really, it's pretty much written in jello at this point. I mean, etched in jello is what mm-hmm. we would say.
Another comment here from Jorge writes in on Twitter, if the Space Force gets installed as our newest service branch and gets its own military academy, are those students considered space cadets? Mr. Hanberg, what do you think?
Yeah, they would be. I mean, you know, space cadets is a term of derision that was really used earlier on the people who were in the Space Command, U.S. Space Command, that got abolished.
Oh, really?
Because they were the ones that had all these visions. They put out a vision statement that was supposed to take us to 2020. It had all kinds of things that they were going to do, but then they got wiped out
mm-hmm.
and all that went away. You know, the ideas didn't go away. The Air Force has had a longstanding cadre of people who have discussed and argued for an enlarged Air Force role in space activities. One of the things they look at is the old Lewis and Clark expedition in 1803. They say that it should be a military-led expedition if we go to a planet, not this civilian stuff that we do with NASA.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is they think it would give you greater control, you would have military personnel there along with scientists, but scientists and other type of people would be there mostly as gathering information, as guests, equivalent to what happened during the Lewis and Clark expedition in 1803.
Mm-hmm.
And they see that as kind of a way into getting a larger Air Force role, and that's what might lead you to an Air Force, Space Force, or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to another comment here on Facebook. Kayla Parks writes in on our page, "One day a Space Force will be necessary, one day, and hopefully it'll have a better name. But in the now, isn't this akin to declaring that we need an Air Force barely a week after Kitty Hawk?" She goes on to write, "This really doesn't need to exist right now. We need a well-funded NASA a whole lot more." Laura Forsick, your thoughts on that? I mean, is this a funding issue that could have some kind of impact on funding for NASA? Because that's a perennial question. How much money can NASA have to do the things that it needs to do? They're always sort of in a budget crunch, right? What could a Space Force do as far as funding for NASA?
Yeah, the budget question is an excellent one because we just don't know. Congress is the one who allocates the budget. And Congress, as Brennan mentioned, it's not fully supportive of this idea. Now, NASA's budget and the military space budget, the DOD, is completely separate. In fact, space military tends to always get more money than civilian NASA.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of taking money from NASA's budget, that's not really what this is about. It's more about taking money from the Air Force Space Command. And that's why a large number of people within the Air Force do not agree with this idea. They want to keep the resources within the Air Force budget. And to some degree, that makes sense. Other people would argue that space would get prioritized more if it was outside of the Air Force's budget. And the Air Force isn't the only one that touches space. Space actually touches all of our military branches. The Navy, for example, has satellites. So those budgets for a Space Force would come from probably from all of the military branches as well as extra budget, but not from NASA.
Do you get the sense, Laura Forsick, that maybe all the other military branches are kind of scrambling right now to think how this might have an impact on them and how they can sort of advocate for a bigger role in whatever a Space Force might end up being?
Absolutely. They're scrambling. In fact, when you look at what the statements have been so far since this was announced, it is a bit of a free-for-all where nobody's quite certain how this is going to work out if it does work out this year. And remember, the budgets are a continual process where we need to approve them and then implement them. And so right now with the NDAA being discussed, with the National Defense Authorization Act, we just don't know if it's going to fit into 2019, 2020. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. I want to get another caller in here. Doug writes, Doug is calling in. Doug, what are your thoughts about the potential for a Space Force? Are you with the idea or you think it's maybe we should put the brakes on it?
Well, first off, I'm against it. I think it's a terrible waste of money. The president has no authority under Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution to institute any kind of military force. That's under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and that power is granted to Congress. Secondly, I'm an engineer, and I happen to know, I've worked in the space program, I happen to know that there's just no practical application of a manned space force, and we already have spent far more than anybody else in the sorts of military satellites and things we do already. There's no real need for this. There's only two countries, or really one country right now, that can deliver a man to space, and that's the Russians,
mm-hmm.
and eventually we can go back. But nobody else has the money or the ability. It's a terrible waste of money. If we spend as much money on the Peace Corps as we spend on the Marine Corps or on something like the Space Corps, the world would be a lot better place. We need to spend this money. You know, you spend it on NASA, but don't spend it on militarizing space,
Doug,
and weaponizing space.
Okay, Doug, I hear you. Thank you so much for weighing in there. Brendan, I see you raising your hand there, but I want to just get one more comment in from Sharon, who writes in on Facebook. This is ridiculous. How can we have a Space Force when we currently have no way to send people into space? Since the last shuttle launch, we've been relying on Russia to get folks up and back from the ISS. So that kind of to Doug's point that Russia is the only country that can get folks into orbit at the moment. What about that, Brendan? What are your thoughts on those?
Well, I want to just talk previously about the first caller there. The NASA had a briefing this week about near-Earth asteroids and the threats that they might permit to Earth,
mm-hmm.
and the questions from the press corps, the Space Force was dominating that. And, you know, it's what would a Space Force do to protect from asteroids? And NASA pretty much put the kibosh on that right away and said, you know, no Bruce Willis. We're not going to a human thing is not going to be someone we're going to send up there. So Bruce Willis, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. To your question about, you know, putting humans in space, and Professor Hanberg mentioned this earlier, is that, yeah, we haven't sent humans into space since the retirement of the shuttle in 2011. That should change. NASA says by the end of this year, it's looking more by 2019 that NASA's contracted with private companies, SpaceX and Boeing, to actually ferry astronauts to the International Space Station. So we'll see humans leave U.S. soil once again, probably in 2019. So it's step by step we're getting back to where we were.
Mm-hmm. Well, Roger Hanberg, let me ask then about another country which you mentioned before, the Chinese and their space program. They've been making a name for themselves. Bring us up to speed. Where is that space program now?
Well, that space program is actually the other country that can send people to orbit, not just the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
They are moving at their own pace. Their concern is no failures, no big failures. And so what they're doing is they're going to start the process of orbiting the pieces to create a Chinese space station by 2022.
Mm-hmm.
This they've opened up supposedly to international members, partners, et cetera. They're basically assuming the position of the International Space Station because right now the administration is going to kill it off in 2025.
They're going to kill off funding. They've got some thoughts on how to keep it going with some private input, right?
But nobody's going to buy that in the private sector. It's too expensive. The problem the United States has is we never think of ourselves as building infrastructure in space.
Mm-hmm.
Where you like put up space stations, you know, they don't have to be as elaborate, but you build them so that you can have human activity occur there over long periods of time. Won't be necessarily the same people. They got to be transferred up and back given the physical effects of microgravity on people and radiation.
Mm-hmm.
But you would be able to develop a very different thing. In that context, a space guard kind of idea might make more sense because you would start having people out there working on other pieces of space equipment that would be in orbit, for example. The original idea of the International Space Station back in the 80s was you'd have the space station and you have a cloud of free flyers.
Right.
These are where you actually do manufacturing. You do other things. People will go visit to take off materials, add materials, take away product, whatever it happens to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, just speaking of other stuff floating around there or flying around our planet, Laura Forsyth, I want to just come back to you real quick in the final minute or so of the show. This week's meeting of the National Space Council wasn't just about focus on the Space Force. They also talked about space junk and how to reduce it. How big of a deal is that?
That's a big deal. In fact, President Trump signed the National Space Policy Directive 3, which directs us to focus more on space traffic management. That is focusing on tracking space debris, space junk, as well as satellites and other objects we have in orbit so it doesn't get too crowded, so we don't have things bouncing into each other and causing more space debris. So that's a big issue, and I'm glad it's finally getting more attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just finally, Brendan Byrne, I mean, all this talk of a space force, it has kind of put the focus back on space. In some ways, is it a good thing? Does it help other agencies like NASA? Because people are now sort of talking more about space, at least this week.
Well, a few takeaways, I think, is one, a lot of this has been lampooning the space force, right? We've seen quite a few pop culture references on just our Facebook page mm-hmm. to this story. I think one thing that's kind of disconcerting is at the same rally that we played some sound from earlier today, the president said, we're reopening NASA again. And I think NASA's never been closed. And a Space Force would have nothing to do with the civilian side of things. So that was a little disheartening to hear President Trump say that. But I think with things like the National Space Council and people talking about space again, as someone who follows this for a job, you know, it's kind of optimistic to start hearing people talk a little bit more about space.
Mm-hmm. So maybe X-wing fighters are a way ways off into the distance.
Very ways off, but people are talking about it.
90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also joined by Roger Hanberg. He's a political scientist at UCF focusing on space and military policy. Roger, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Laura Forsyth, founder of Astrolytical, space analysis and consulting firm. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, amid mounting criticism, President Trump signed an executive order he says will end separation of families crossing the U.S. border illegally. what's next for those families and for unaccompanied minors in detention facilities in the United States. We'll have a discussion about that when we're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. On Wednesday, President Trump signed an executive order he says will end the separation of parents and children crossing the US border illegally. So just what does that executive order mean for undocumented immigrants caught up in the federal government's zero-tolerance immigration policy? What's the outlook for children in detention, those who've been separated at the border and those who've come to the United States as unaccompanied minors? For more, we're joined by Orlando immigration attorney John Guyon. He's a former senior attorney with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. He now represents clients facing deportation. John Guyon, where do we stand right now as far as federal immigration policy and what it means for undocumented immigrants crossing the border?
Matthew, we stand at a crossroads. This is a very difficult time for everybody involved in this. Both parties have seen very awful things going on at our southern border, both in the detention centers and in the makeshift and temporary or less permanent detention centers, as they talk about it. And we've seen just some really horrific pictures about children who have been separated from their families. The interesting part about this is it's really a criminal prosecution policy that caused all of this and not an immigration policy. A few months ago, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, said that there was going to be a zero tolerance policy for people who were crossing the southern border illegally in violation of federal criminal law. Now, it's also a violation of federal immigration law, but the prosecution of parents who were traveling into the United States and crossed illegally with children, their prosecution in federal court is what's caused the roughly 2,000 children to be separated from their parents. And so that's where we are now, is we have an interesting dynamic where over the last few months, a change in federal criminal prosecution policy has caused this immigration nightmare.
John Guyon, do you have any clients in the situation that we've been hearing about, parents separated from their children at the southern border? Because there is that facility in South Florida which is holding kids in detention, either kids who've crossed the border as unaccompanied minors or have been separated from their parents at the southern border.
Currently, I don't represent any of the unaccompanied minors or children being detained down in South Florida. We have one of the facilities that is able to handle long-term detention of minors down in South Florida. And I try not to handle those types of cases just because of the distance between my office in Central Florida and those facilities in Southern Florida. It's just I'm not able to give those clients all of the time and attention that they need. I have many colleagues in South Florida who represent individuals down there, and they've reported to me just heartbreaking stories of these children being taken away from their parents, and they have been transported, some of them, down to South Florida.
So if the issue is one of criminal prosecution rather than immigration law, what can Congress do, in your opinion, to fix this? Because President Trump and some lawmakers are saying this is a problem that Congress hasn't solved, and that's why we're in this situation.
Well, I don't think that this is a problem that Congress caused or a problem that Congress can necessarily solve. The president runs the executive branch. If he uses his prosecutors in federal court to exercise prosecutorial discretion to prosecute every single person who breaks federal immigration criminal laws, then they are going to be separated from their children if they happen to be crossing over into the United States with children. I think what the president is talking about is he wants more bed space so that he can detain individuals who have violated our immigration laws together with their children in detention, which is what he basically signed with that executive order. The executive order doesn't change the 100% prosecution goal that they have. What it does is it says we're going to keep together these family units, we're going to prosecute the parents, and we're going to detain both the children and the parents, but now we're going to detain them together instead of separately.
Is there a bit of wait and see that has to go on here? Do we just have to see how this executive order plays out?
I don't know how long we're going to have to wait, because I anticipate there's going to be a fight in federal court very, very quickly. In fact, in the executive order itself, the president directed the attorney general to go back to the district court who handled what we call the Flores case, which has been evolving over the last few decades. But the president has told the attorney general, go back to court, and fight for my executive order, because the president understands that right now this executive order is in violation of an existing court order. And so we're not going to have to wait very long to see how this plays out. And I anticipate that we're going to have something very, very quickly on this. As far as the federal courts are concerned, we may have a temporary restraining order. We may have some sort of injunction nationwide. But I don't think this executive order is going to last very long legally.
So what about the rights of these children? There's different categories of children in detention. Some have been separated from their parents at the border, and others have come across the border as unaccompanied minors. What can you tell us about what the outlook is for them?
Sure. I have represented many unaccompanied minors who have come into the United States as children by themselves. They were either sent here by their parents for a better life, not through the normal channels of, let's say, a visa or a green card or something along those lines, but to cross the border illegally. So what we do see with these individuals is they have a whole lot more rights than your typical adult who crosses the border without having a visa and then applies for asylum. They get, in essence, two bites at the apple. They get to have their asylum case heard in two different situations. If they are detained, it has to be in the least restrictive facility possible. Many of them are released and are not detained. And I think it's important to remember that we have a little over probably 10 to 12,000 children currently in immigration detention nationwide. And the overwhelming majority of those children came to the country by themselves. They are unaccompanied minors. And so we do have a tremendous problem with this at the southern border, because this is just not a great situation for anybody who's got to make that perilous journey, either from halfway across the world. You know, I have clients from Bangladesh who came in as children and were smuggled all the way across the world into our southern border. And then you have many Mexican children who have done it. But it's a horrible, horribly dangerous journey, and it's one that people only do when they're extremely desperate. And so the majority of these children are claiming asylum, claiming a fear of going back to their home country. And many of them were able to win their asylum cases until very recently, when the Attorney General kind of turned our asylum case law upside down in a decision that really changed the landscape for both people fleeing domestic violence in other countries and our unaccompanied minors fleeing the gang violence.
And what about that asylum law then? Does there need to be an update to how that law functions?
Well, our asylum law is what it is, and it has been for a very long time, but we've developed little nuances and little carve-outs for different groups to qualify for asylum. We've always had political asylum in the U.S. We've always had religious asylum in the U.S. It's the area of asylum law that involves particular social groups. That's the one that's really evolved a lot, and that's subject to interpretation. So the Attorney General can say that he doesn't believe that domestic violence victims or children fleeing gang violence or anyone fleeing gang violence should qualify for asylum. But ultimately, it's going to be up to the federal courts, who will review the Attorney General and his designees' decisions to decide whether or not these individuals will qualify for asylum under asylum law. And we're very, very new into this this new upside-down asylum case law that the Attorney General put on us. And so we have to wait and see how that plays out, and it's going to be many months and many years before we really see how it works.
So just back to the kids and some of the clients that you've represented, John Guyon, do some of them spend quite some time in detention, like months, if not years?
Absolutely. When the children are detained, and most of the time it's because they don't have anybody here in the United States. The federal government would like to release the children who are not dangerous, who haven't committed any violent crimes, who are not national security threats, obviously, for the most part. The government would like to release them to a family member, to a loved one, to a sponsor who can take care of them, because it's a better situation for everybody. And that's what the government does in many cases. However, if there's no one to turn the child over to in the United States, the federal government's not going to release a child to be on their own, just like they wouldn't release an American child to go and live on their own. And so in that regard, we have many children who are in detention for long periods of time in some of these youth camps and situations like we have in South Florida. And so they can be detained for many months while their cases go on, and sometimes for, you know, up to multiple years. Immigration cases take a very long time.
So the clients you've represented, the first time you see them, do they understand what their situation is and what the outlook is? You know, the fact that they might be spending quite some time in these detention facilities?
Absolutely not. Most of the young people that I have done consultations with, either detained or recently non-detained, they have no idea about our immigration laws. Immigration laws are difficult to understand for immigration attorneys who practice them all the time, let alone a child who doesn't speak English, who recently went on a multi-month or week journey into the United States, who has no parental guidance. These individuals have no clue what's going on. They are thrown into what is usually a much better situation than when they came from, but they still don't understand that the future isn't necessarily going to be, you know, rainbows and unicorns for them. A lot of times it's a long time of detention, a long time of not knowing what's going to go on in their lives, a long time of fighting with the system, trying to obtain documents to exist, like a driver's license or an ID card. And many times it ends up with them losing their cases and being ordered deported, and then, you know, they become very hopeless. And they don't understand why they were sent to the United States, and then they have to leave. It's very, very difficult for these unaccompanied minors, mostly, to try to navigate this system.
And what about the notion of deterrent effect? I'm wondering if you're hearing anything from folks who are undocumented and who are seeking legal help to get status in the United States about what they've heard before coming to the States and what they now know about the threat of family separation or detention and deportation once they get to the border.
Yes, absolutely. And I, as a former government attorney, you don't get the perspective that I've had now being in private practice. As a government attorney, you just assume everybody knows the law, and you don't understand why someone would pay to have their child smuggled to the United States for a better life when there's no chance for them to win their asylum claim. But what you learn on this side when dealing with individuals who have come to the United States is you really get their backstory, and they're very honest with you that a lot of these families have saved up an entire life savings and borrowed into the future, some of them into indentured servitude for the parents, just to send their kids to the United States because they heard an uncle or a cousin or a friend got to the United States, got a work permit, and was able to stay. And so the misinformation that is traveling from the United States, both willfully and just ignorantly, to Central American countries and other countries is astounding. Family separation is not something that immediately goes out over Twitter to the really poor slums in Guatemala and El Salvador. You know, people who have spent many months to many years saving up their money to come to the United States aren't suddenly going to change their mind when they reach Mexico and the U.S. border because they're afraid of family separation. They are past the point of no return. As soon as they pay those smugglers, as soon as they pay the coyotes, as soon as they have really started on their journey, they can't go back. They've given up everything. And so it's going to be a slow trickle of this family separation policy and all of these horror stories. It's going to be a slow trickle back into Central America to act as a deterrent, but I think eventually it probably will. If not for a long period of time, at least a short period of time.
John Guyon, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
Coming up, Matt Burke moved from DeLand to Chicago, and when he came back, he brought some Chicago blues with him. The conversation and performance from Matt Burke when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit a conversation with Matt Burke. He's the lead singer of the DeLand-based Matt Burke Band, and he spoke to 90.7's Brendan Byrne back in January. Where the pressure is on, we see to inspire. We got them evening embers blowing amber. Now it's time to start a fire. We got something started, babe. Flames are burning high.
Bring us to one of your concerts. What can you expect when you go to see the Matt Burke Band live?
Right. Okay. So, I mean, the sound has kind of changed over the years. We've got a new album coming out this month, and the sound it's really bluesy. It kind of pulls from the time I spent in Chicago and the influences I got up there. I moved back to Florida 3 years ago and started developing this version of the Matt Burke Band. And so The new shows, I mean, it's bluesy, it's rootsy, it's rocky, you know, it's got funky moments. It's, you know, it's hard to pin down exactly what genre it is. I think the Twitter handle says something along the lines of funky, soulful, bluesy, rootsy. I mean, it's, we throw in all of that. Mm-hmm. So it's a good time for sure.
Now, you grew up in DeLand. You said you moved to Chicago, and now you're back. Mm-hmm. Walk me through your early days of exploring music and playing music and writing music. Where did you get this inspiration, this passion from?
Sure. Music's always something I've been involved with. I started singing at a very early age, second or third grade. Picked up my first guitar around sixth grade, you know, and by eighth grade I was, you know, learning Nirvana tunes and doing the grunge rock thing. And that transitioned in college into kind of that that new metal movement that was going on in the late 90s, that Korn, Limp Bizkit kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was my first start, was in a new metal band called Postal. And we, you know, played the FBI in Orlando and thought we were big shots. And so that was kind of the start. That carried over into college. That band dissolved on me, and I started doing singer-songwriter stuff around the bars and the coffee houses. And that was really when I started writing original music that had more of a Americana, folksy kind of lean towards what I do now.
I want to talk a little bit about your time spent in Chicago, and maybe this is a two-parter question here, but Chicago, it has that defined Chicago blues, mm-hmm. Chicago soul sound.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn while you were there, and you brought it back here? And do places like DeLand and New Smyrna and Central Florida, do they have their own defined sound? Like
absolutely,
Chicago?
Yeah, great questions. You know, Chicago, it's interesting. When I got involved in the music scene up there, it was largely the cover band circuit. I mean, that cover band, tribute band thing in Chicago is huge. When people go out to see music, I'd say 70-80% of it is going to see these tribute acts. And they're really great at what they do. So from that standpoint, I was really learning some stage presence, some performance tricks, you know, how to have an engaging show. But at the same time, I was developing my original music, which was largely being shaped by the sounds I was hearing in Chicago, specifically, you know, Kingston Mines and these Buddy Guy's Blues mm-hmm. Club and these late night places where those real deal guys that have been there for, you know, tens of years are still out there just really killing it, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's a distinctive vibe for sure that I think is really reflected in the new stuff. Moving back down here, you know, it was a cool time, you know, with like Gary Clark Jr. I feel like that was the time where blues started getting in the forefront of popular music again, you know, and mm-hmm. you can see that in the past 5 or 10 years. There's a real undercurrent, the Black Keys, you know, like all of this stuff that really kind of resurged. And so I was happy to be doing what I was doing at that time. Getting back down into Florida, all of a sudden, it's, you know, the original music scene around here is very much, there's a lot of reggae going on where I am. There's a lot of that dub going on, you know, and what I do isn't necessarily that. So it's been interesting to see my stuff work in some places and not work in other places for those exact reasons.
Now, you play a lot in DeLand, New Smyrna. What is the scene like there? I mean, where are some of the places that you play? And, you know, are you playing to the back of people's heads there? Or are people engaged?
I try not to. I've pretty much whittled those back of the people's heads gigs out at this point. So I play the Treehouse Bar in New Smyrna pretty consistently. That's a great spot for just solo or for duo stuff. You know, it's got the feel of a listening room up there, you know, but then it's still a full bar with a menu, you know, but people are actively paying attention to the music up there. You know, my band, the full band, was pretty consistently doing Cafe Da Vinci in DeLand for about two and a half years. We did New Year's Eve, not this past year, but the year before. So it really worked well over there. Being from DeLand, I've got a large fan base there. A lot of people know me, you know, so it was nice to build out there. We picked up, I think it was every other Thursday for Ladies Night when nobody knew who we were when I first got back and just grinded it out, you know, old school. So, yeah, I do believe there's a market for it out there. I'm excited to keep pushing into Orlando and bring the sound in there as well.
Tell me a little bit about where you play and where our listeners can go out and see you or log online and check out some of your tunes.
For sure. So everything about me can be found at mattburkeband.com. That's B-U-R-K-E, M-A-T-T-B-U-R-K-E, band.com. I try to keep the show schedule pretty actively updated there. So, you know, we've got monthly gigs over at the Treehouse Bar in New Smyrna, Stonewood Grill out in Ormond Beach. Cafe Da Vinci is still popping up from time to time. And then we do, you know, Liam Fitzpatrick's out in Lake Mary. And like I said, I'm actively working my way into some of the more original music rooms in Orlando and in Winter Park and in that area. So if anyone listening wants to have me out, I'd be more than happy to come play your place.
Well, Matt Burke, would you mind playing us out of the show?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to.
What would you like to play?
This is off my new album. It's probably the most country song I've ever written. It's called War With Myself. So kind of a neo-country, alt-country sort of thing.
We've been speaking with Matt Burke of the Matt Burke Band. Matt, thanks so much for joining us and looking forward to hearing the song.
Thanks for having me.
When I'm a simple man, I got these simple things I like to feel good when I can. I tend to take my life in stride, mostly living for today. But tomorrow's coming up quick, don't want to waste away. I think I'm gonna read it all in a little bit. Ain't no telling how this will end, but it'll be a low-down shame. Time comes for my sweet surrender, and I'm yelling out I'm the one to blame. I've been spending my days and nights just losing ground, waging war upon myself. Friend of fire in a smoked-out battleground, laying low, catching hell. Solitary in a one-man jail cell. Born to run, I was born to kill. But my blood is the blood I'm spilling.
And you're listening to Matt Burke of the DeLand-based Matt Burke Band. He spoke to 90.7's Brendan Byrne and performed on Intersection back in January. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Brenda Argueta. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor, Abe Abariah, and Crystal Chavez. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.
It'll be low-down shame if can't settle on some common ground. Busy fighting over who's the one to blame. I've been spending my days and nights just losing ground, waging war upon myself. Friend of fire in a smoked-out battleground, laying low, catching hell. I feel like running cause we're going nowhere, holding tighter to this hope for change. Blood is running out while future facing at war with myself. Though the weight of life feels so heavy, gotta find a way to make it through. Life's ahead if we can just hold steady. Keep from numbing up a point of view. Keep on breathing, keep it in the moment. Or else the present simply passes by.